This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. This is episode 375. Dun, dun, dun. That sounds like a big milestone. I'm not sure it is, but it certainly sounds like a milestone. 375. Actually, the next big milestone will be the 8 years worth of podcasts, but we've got a little while to get to that one because 52 times 8 is 416. So we're a little ways away from that, but before you know it, it will be here on our way to 2000. I think I mentioned last week that I've been trying to hit this goal of 10,000 words a week for 8 weeks, 80,000 words. I did hit that. Yay! Then I promptly turned around and re-edited some stuff and knocked out about 3,000 words, which put me back down to about 77,000 words for book 5 of the Windfall series. However, we're gonna call it a win. Because as of Saturday of last week, it had been 8 weeks of writing, and I had 80,000 words. So, yay. It's funny because I'm back editing on the book now, and I had been writing so fast for so long, for those 2 months, that when I actually just kind of stopped, I felt a little lost. I kept thinking, maybe I should write some more. And then I was like, no, you have another book to edit. Because now I'm back editing book 4. The information for the beta readers has come back in. I would guess there's going to be a little more information that's trickling in at this point from a couple of more beta readers. But I think most of it is back in at this point. I've got a couple of my loyal and kind and generous beta readers that haven't responded yet, which I'm a bit surprised about. But, or if they have responded, I haven't gotten their input. It's gotten trapped somewhere or lost somewhere, so I will follow up with them in the last little bit here and say, okay, just to confirm, once I start running out of information. I was having some trouble with book 5. One of my characterizations just wasn't laying in. But I think I got that worked out. It's funny. I was ramping up for, you know, one of the big dramatic scenes, and I quit writing before I got to that point, so my brain is still buzzing on that. So even as I'm working on book 4, I'm trying to work out exactly what's going to happen in that scene and then what's beyond that scene. Because I think I'm somewhere in the 250-page range of the manuscript, and that means I'm over halfway. So I probably have another 200-ish pages to go, and I have enough story to tell. I'm actually a bit concerned that I'm gonna have to rein it in so I don't go too far on this, but there's a lot of story to tell in those last 200 pages, and I'm probably going to have at least another 25 pages to get finished with the section I'm in now, and so I really have only about 175 pages to finish up that story. But it'll be fine. It'll work out fine. Part of the glory of this, part of the joy of it, is taking one foot and making one step in the fog. And then doing that again, and then doing that again, and realizing at some point, well, hey, that worked out pretty good. So it's a good exercise. Everything's going fine at work. I know I pretty much say that every week, but I think it's going fine. We are closing in on making a decision on a business process management platform And that seems to be, I think it's going to be fine. There's a few little hitches in the get along when I've been trying to do some demo things, but they'll get those worked out, I hope. So we'll see how that goes. Anyways, my notes this week really are just about things that made me giggle this week. Things that made me smile. There is a certain hubris to mankind that is an amazing thing to behold. And frankly, it has served mankind quite well, because we have this idea that we can figure stuff out. That given enough time, we'll bang around, we'll make it work. And that's good. That's nothing wrong with that. Where it gets interesting is where it extends beyond what we should be claiming and blinds us to our assumptions. And it's not like that blinding has simply started. We've been blind to assumptions for a long time. It's easy for us to look back at people who have gone before and say, well, that's just because they're ignorant. No, there were a lot of smart people back in those days. But, you know, they just didn't necessarily have the tool set. I know it's easy now to look back on things like the Copernican view, not the Copernican view, the Galileo view, whichever view it was that said that Earth was at the center. Because you could make observations and you could make some case for the fact that Earth was into the center. It certainly looks like that. The sun comes up in the east and sets in the west every day. It certainly looks like everything outside of us is moving, and we're special, and we're the ones that are in the center. It's easy to look back at them and go, what was wrong with them? But the fact was that at that time, that's the best we had. So I think we need to be really careful as we move forward to just assume that what we have now, well, it just must be completely right. And so when people make that assumption, well, we must be just completely right, it's obvious that we're right, I just smile. So a couple of days ago, there was this article about this comet, 67P as in Paul. These articles started firing off everywhere. The first one I came across had the headline, Rosetta's Comet 64P has vital ingredients for life, except energy. Okay, and I start reading down through this article, and it's like, yeah, okay. Well, the upshot of it was that scientists have found a vital amino acid and a rich selection of organic molecules in the comet's dusty atmosphere for the first time ever. Now, why is this important? This is important because scientists are struggling to figure out how life began on Earth. Because it's a pretty complex deal. You got to get all these molecules arranged in the right order, yada, 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 yada. So, to help themselves along, what they've done is they've broken it all down into some basic components, amino acids, organic molecules, and they've made the assumption that if you can just get a bunch of these in a soup and toss them around for long enough, well, I'm sure that eventually that'll form DNA. I told a friend this week, this would be like saying, I have this handful of sand, and it has silicon in it, and I'm sure if I just shook it around and put it in a soup for long enough, it would make a computer chip. But neither here nor there, the Rosetta spacecraft has found glycine. It's an amino acid, and a few of its precursor organic molecules, along with the crucial element phosphorus, in a cloud composed of dust and gas surrounding the comet 67P, and they have another name for it, which I'm not going to be able to pronounce. It's the Kuryumov-Gerasimenko. But anyways, so, ta-da! Quote, researchers said the discovery of the building blocks in the comet's surrounding atmosphere so has supported the hypothesis that comets might have played a vital role in the development of life on early Earth. They were talking to a scientist, his last name is Altweg. Altweg told space.com, energy is completely missing on comet, on a comet. So on a comet, there's no A in there, it just says, so on comet, you cannot form life. But once you have comet in warm place, English is the second language apparently. Once you have comet in warm place, let's say it drops into ocean, then these molecules get free, get mobile, can react, and maybe that's how life starts. So we're taking a bunch of leaps here. We're just taking a bunch of leaps. That's how life starts, because this is a problem. This is a problem for scientists. How does life start? And most of them are content to assume that they're right if you just take a bunch of these molecules and slop them around in a soup, that somehow it gets started. Okay, keep that thought in mind. According to a report in U.S. News, by Frank Jordan's quote, scientists have found further evidence supporting the theory that some of the building blocks for life may have come to Earth from outer space. Quote, this means that happened a long time ago in the cloud in which our solar system emerged. Oh, this means that what happened? Okay, so, okay, blah, 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 blah. And this is another common theme, that if it happened here, it probably happened everywhere. Because we're not special. That's a really important theme through all of this. We're not special, okay? So, quote, that means what has happened a long time ago in the cloud from which our solar system emerged could happen in all clouds. Then you just need another planetary system forming with a planet at the right position, and you could have another go at life. It may not be successful. And this is another theme. But there are billions of stars, as we know, billions of planets, so chances are good. It's this always this appeal to time. It's appeal to these big numbers. It must be right. Now, you know, someone then goes on to say, well, the exact story behind life's formation on Earth is unknown, and scientists have voiced different theories regarding this issue. But they're pretty happy with the fact that probably stuff came from comets, and then you just mixed it up in the soup, and then magic happened. There's an old, I think it's a Far Side cartoon, that there's this blackboard, and this scientist is writing all on this stuff. And down in the corner, there's a little phrase, and there's another scientist pointing at that phrase, and the scientist says, I think you need to be more specific in this spot, and the phrase is, then a miracle occurs. And that's what I feel like when I read all this stuff. You know, it's like, well, sure, that happened, and then this happened, and billions of planets! So anyways, that was one thing that amused me. The second thing that amused me this week is there's a new documentary, relatively new, on Netflix called The Drake Equation, where they celebrate the Drake Equation. The Drake Equation is an equation that was made up by a guy named Drake, a scientist. And this supposedly predicts the approximate number of advanced civilizations there might be in our universe. And so justifies the fact that we should have this search for extraterrestrial intelligence. not just life, intelligence. So look through the radio waves, see if we can find stuff, also known as SETI. Okay. You know, I really don't have any problem with the equation itself. The equation is basically you can get the number of probable intelligent civilizations out there by taking the number of stars formed per year, multiplying that by the fraction of the stars with planets. Okay, I get that. Multiplying back by the number of planets suitable for life. Okay. Multiplying that by the fraction of planets on which life appears. Okay, fine. Multiply that by the fractions of planets that might become technologically advanced according to that life. Okay, multiplying by the number of years that they might transmit. So, ta-da, there you go. So he starts off, when he started up, decided he'd put numbers to all this. He said, well, you know, it's pretty much observed that you've got about 10 stars per year. Okay, well, that's fine. That's something we can observe. And at that time, they didn't have Kepler, but, you know, we figured, probably about half of those stars have planets. So they pull half of those stars have planets out of the blue. Now, what Kepler has taught us is there is a bunch of stars with planets. It has also taught us that a bunch of those planets, there is no chance you're going to get life on them. At least not as we know it, Jim. You know, from Star Trek. It's life, Jim, but not as we know it. Because they're too far, they're too big, too heavy in gravity, they don't have any magnetic, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, okay. Then, how many hospitable planets per star? Well, two. Because they said, you know, we have Earth, and Mars probably would have made it with just a little tweak, so we'll go ahead and assume in our favor. Which they do. So they end up with two for the number of hospitable planets. This was their initial estimates. Then they come to what percentage of these hospitable planets will life arise on? And they put the fraction at 1. Now, for those of you who aren't used to working with fractions, that's 100%. They decided that, well, life arose on this planet, and it was hospitable, so therefore, it's likely that life is going to arise on every single planet that is hospitable. What? Because we're not special. Okay. So, then they have to come up with the number for, well, once you have life arising, what are the chances that life will become intelligent? Well, they estimated that at 50%. Sure. You know, once we have life, it's pretty much destined to become intelligent. Okay. And then they decided that all intelligent life, obviously, will want to communicate. So they put that at 100% too. All right. Which I'm not sure that's a good assumption. So, multiplying all that out, they decided, well, see, according to our very scientific formula here, I'm getting my mail, one moment, according to our extremely scientific formula here, that must mean that there's probably 50,000 planets out there, or 50,000 civilizations out there that are wanting to communicate with us. Okay, well, sure, if you want to put those numbers to it. Now, of course, there's other people that have other numbers, and if you change too many of those numbers too much, the numbers can swing drastically in a different direction. And if you decide that maybe life arising is a lot harder than 1, then 100% of the time it's going to happen, that number of civilization plummets And if you decide that it's harder for intelligent life to arise, it plummets, etc., etc. My whole point in all of this, I'm backing into my garage one moment. My whole point in all of this is there is a ton of assumptions that goes into all this. And yet when you hear some of these, you're like, well, we just thought that sounded good. Okay, sure. Because we're not special. That has to be the thing. So with all of this then, to me, there's another side of this coin that is amusing. And that is, we have some very forward thinkers, very intelligent guys, who will sit there and look at you and will tell you that it's highly likely, it's highly probable, once again using these billions and billions of planets, billions, you know, tens of thousands of civilizations, they'll all become intelligent, you know, using exactly the same arguments that they use for SETI, that there's obviously other civilizations out there. Using exactly those same arguments, they will come to the conclusion that it's highly likely that we are, in fact, living in a simulation, that we didn't evolve from nothing, that we are, in fact, in a digital world, and that everything we see is being created by some massive computer in the sky, and everything we're feeling and experiencing is just the interaction of some, not transistors, probably some quantum computer somewhere. That, in fact, this whole idea that we are not special might be absolutely true because we're just one of billions of simulations that have been spun up to test different things. Maybe to try to find out the answer to questions like, how do we have meaning in life? What is love? You know, all these big, big epic questions. Maybe we're just in this giant simulator trying to have our keepers figure these things out. And the really amusing part about that to me is that for the people who are out with SETI, with jumping up and down, that in fact a comet has these precursors to life, according to them, their whole goal there, when you kind of rip it all down, is to show that life just arises by random chance, and therefore there is no God, and we don't need a God. Which seems to me to be directly opposed to the idea that it's probable, if you just want to take the probabilities, that we live in a simulation. Because then, whatever you want to call it, the thing that's running the simulation, the thing that has programmed the simulation, I mean, that's God. Because who's ever running this thing and programming it can turn things on, turn things off, can see everywhere at the same time, can have all knowledge. That's our definition of God. So on one side, you have people taking a certain line of reasoning and rejoicing in it because they feel like that gets them closer to the idea of no God. And then on the other side, you have people who are taking the exact same thought process, the exact same assumptions, and they run themselves into into a state where they may not want to call it God, but it sounds pretty close to God to me. It's just amusing to me, that's all. So I just think we should just kind of relax about things and not be so quick to assume in our own favor. And to acknowledge that there is a mystery about this life, and that, as the guy on the end of the Drake equation said, he quoted Arthur C. Clarke, who said something about, we may be one of many, many civilizations, or we may be the only one. And he said, I find either case to be astounding. So who knows for sure? It just makes me smile when you hear learned men and women speaking with such certainty, because it becomes pretty obvious at that point that, in fact, there is something else that's driving that certainty, and it's really not the facts and conditions that are in front of them. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.